And welcome back to Dad's on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Jeff Apter. Jeff is the author of 30 music biographies. It has been our pleasure to have Jeff on the show previously to talk about his books on Bon Scott, John English, Malcolm Young, George Young, most of those coming from either the Easy Beats or AC/DC. Jeff, welcome back to Dad's on the Air.
Thanks for having me back, Bill. Good to talk to you.
Jeff's latest book is about the Aussie superstar Keith Urban. It's a mystery that Keith Urban always seems to have been a bigger star in the US than in his home country. Now, I hope your book helps to change that, but why do you think that is?
It's an interesting phenomenon, isn't it? Yeah. I think it's because even as a kid, he always had his sights set on America, in particular Nashville. When he was growing up, his father was his biggest musical influence, his father Bob Urban, and who was a sort of larger-than-life character, loved everything American, drove a big gas-guzzling car, and loved American music, particularly that classic-era country, kind of country pop, when you had Johnny Cash, Glen Campbell, Charlie Pride, all these acts that had these huge, essentially country hits that crossed over into the mainstream. And Keith was raised on these records. And he'd look at the albums, because this, of course, back in the classic days of vinyl, he'd look at the albums and he kept seeing this name, this word, Nashville, Nashville, Nashville. And he couldn't work it out whether it was a place or a person or something else. He had no idea, but he knew that somehow that's where he was meant to be. You know, he picked up a guitar at about six and was playing publicly at about nine or ten. So he was always, always playing this music. He loved Dolly Parton as well. He loved really strong and very, I guess, very commercial country music. He really set his sights on it and some success in Australia. He won, you know, Golden Guitars at Tamworth, and he was really well received. He played in a number of local acts that were essentially sort of jukebox acts, playing covers and so on. But, you know, for the time he left school at 15, he was on the road, basically. But again, always with this grand plan, I've got to get to Nashville, I've got to get to Nashville and establish myself there. And he started going there in the late 80s when he was in his early 20s. You know, he has a record deal in Australia. He went over there and thinking it was going to be, you know, pretty straightforward, go knocking a few doors, but he kept getting rejected. And it wasn't until he established himself there in the mid-90s and when he decided, okay, I've got to live here, which is really, if you look back through, you know, the successful Australian acts who have succeeded in America, and that's people like Helen Reddy, Peter Allen, the Bee Gees, and then later on bands like In Excess, Little River Band, they've all either established themselves in America or spent most of their time there. And that's what Keith decided to do. He really, his pot of gold was basically to crack the American market. And then in a funny sort of way, he's worked his way back into the Australian consciousness. And in only the last couple of years, had his first top 10 hit in Australia with a song that he recorded with the pop singer Pink called One Too Many. So that was, you know, probably 30 years in the making, by which time he'd had 40 chart hits in America. So it's very strange. He's much loved here. I think his star has risen higher here than it ever has, even when he was living here. So he's had a sort of back-to-front career, I guess.
Keith Urban is another Kiwi we want to claim as our own after his international success. But he's had a lot of detours on the ways, and he's been to some really dark places, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. You know, those first rejections that he got in Nashville really, particularly when he moved there in about 95, and he set himself up with a band called The Ranch. They got a good record deal. They were managed by a guy called Miles Copeland, who managed The Police. You know, a huge international act, a country rock version of The Police. So they had a lot going for them, but they made a record that just stiffed. It just failed. There was probably too much record company intervention. No one was really sure what kind of record they were going to make, and it was out of time. You know, this is an era when people like Garth Brooks and Shania Twain and George Strait are really coming through, and country is really becoming kind of crossing over into the pop charts. But Keith made a very authentically sort of country rock record didn't fit, cost a lot of money, and it was a huge failure, and he took it very, very, very badly. He always had a sort of a wild streak as a younger guy, and he really descended into, as he readily admits himself, he really descended into a sort of drug and booze-fueled chaos in his life. He ended up in rehab, and it was only a couple of weeks before that time when I actually first encountered him myself, when I was in Nashville in June 1998, and I met him briefly there. And I did not know at the time, but someone mentioned he'd been doing it tough, and as it turns out, he had, because within, I think within weeks, he was doing his first stint in rehab, trying to get his act together, and within a couple of years, he finally cracked the American charts.
Well, and even in his home life, I mean, he started off as a primary school student coming home from school and finding his house had burnt down, which...
it's crazy, isn't it? It's like something out of a really bad country song.
Exactly, yeah. He's got the roots there, but... in those days, too, you talk about him having his first serious guitar, which was a red Fender Stratocaster. I'm just amused at the time, years later, when there was a flood in Nashville and he lost his 50 favourite guitars.
He was well stocked, wasn't he? that was during the huge floods, I think, in 2010. And I'm looking out my window now at Wollongong thinking, well, I'm glad I don't have my guitars in storage anywhere because they might be in danger at the moment. But, yeah, he certainly had a good arsenal. He was a big collector. Interestingly, among those instruments that were damaged, one that he did salvage was a guitar that he bought in New York, again, very early in his American odyssey, but with money that, you know, I think it was a $2,500 guitar that he couldn't afford but somehow found the money to buy it. He called it Clarence, I think, after a character in It's a Wonderful Life, which is one of his favourite films. And he saw it as a good luck charm, and he actually took it to a luthier and got it repaired and continues to play and record with it. So, yeah, he's got a deep attachment to his guitars, more so than his family, but that's not true.
No. I think
there is a funny story, because he's now got two almost teenage daughters, and he's, you know, been married for 15 years, but there's a story that when it gets a little too, I think he said when it gets a little too estrogen-heavy at home, he locks himself away in his studio and noodles away on his guitar. He never lost that.
No. Well, yes, and I guess the number of guitars you need is always plus one, whatever the first number is. But you talked about him having this feeling about Nashville early on. Do you think he ever doubted that he had that destiny to be a star in Nashville?
No, and that resilience, that absolute firm commitment and belief that he was eventually going to succeed there, that's what kept him going, particularly through that dark phase I was talking about before, because, you know, so many Australians had tried and failed there before. Most notably, I guess, in Keith's era was James Blundell. James, huge Australian star here, who'd crossed over into the mainstream, if you remember, with Way Out West, which he recorded with James Rain. It was a big hit. He got an American recording deal, went over there, and essentially discovered that they wanted to transform him into an American act, you know, with the big hat and the accent and everything. And he said, no, what I want to do is bring Australian country music or rural music, you know, that he was writing and recording here. He wanted to try to deliver it to the American market, and it failed. It didn't work at all, you know. So, but no, Keith, I think, always knew that because he was different from James, for instance. James, very strongly Australian influence on his work, on his lyrics and his style of country, whereas Keith was always embracing American music. And that's what I think helped him eventually succeed there, amongst a number of things. But he had a good awareness of what Americans listened to, what fitted on the radio, you know, what were the kind of records that people kept going back to, which in a lot of cases were the records that he grew up on. He had that. But yeah, so there was a period, you know, when it did go terribly wrong for him. I'm sure he entertained the idea of going back to Australia, but, you know, back to what? You really feel like a failure. I think he would have felt like a complete failure if he'd come back here, and I'm pretty sure his self-esteem was pretty shaky at the time. So he soldiered on. He surrounded himself with good people. He had a record publisher, a couple, Jewel and Barry Coburn, who Keith knew from Australia. Jewel herself had been a country star in her youth, and she'd had some success in America. They were part of his sort of extended family in America. He got a good manager, a guy called Gary Borman. You know, even to his record company was Capitol, which was one of the bigger country music record labels. So a lot of people around him really became sort of team Urban, and they stuck by him. You know, Jewel Coburn told me stories of Keith calling her from rehab at 2 or 3 in the morning, and they're having these long, extended conversations about what he should do next, how he should approach the next stage of his career. You know, once I'm out of here, this is what I intend to do. So he always had a pretty clear vision of succeeding there, but it just took a lot longer than he anticipated.
And there seems to have been a pretty strong influence from his father, Bob, you mentioned earlier, but and I think Keith even wrote a song about his father, but that seemed to be an ongoing influence, and in some ways Keith was like him.
Yeah, well, look, there's no doubt Bob was a big drinker, and Keith inherited that gene until he really tackled his demons and went into rehab for, I think it was the third time in 2006 or thereabouts, and that's when he really finally, I guess, you never get rid of that demon, but he found a way to circumvent it, I guess. You know, he now says he happily serves alcohol to guests at home, but says, I can't drink, I'm allergic. Which I think is a pretty good way of dealing with it. Yeah, he inherited a lot from him, good and bad. There's even a question mark about how the house burned down, you know, because Bob was the only one at home at the time, so no one's really answered that. And Bob passed away a few years ago, and I think it was a big loss for Keith, and I think he felt that very, very deeply. They had this sort of complicated relationships that a lot of fathers and sons have, and particularly in their case, because Keith's career really amplified that. You know, he was always citing the big influence that his father had had on him musically. So even though if you listen to his music today, he's strayed a long way from what really helped him crack the American market. He's now more of a, I don't know, like a modern pop act. You know, he's recording with Pink and Taylor Swift and, you know, rappers, kinds of unlikely people. But I think he's deep inside, he's still got a country sort of country heart, if you like. There's always a little bit of twang in his records.
We're speaking today with Jeff Apter, who is the author of a new book called Keith Urban, and that is the topic of the book, all about our Australian superstar doing so well in America. Jeff, we might take a break here and ask you if you'd like to pick a song for the program.
Yeah, I picked a song called Walk in the Country. Now, this is from the first record that Keith recorded in America with his band, The Ranch. The record, in the wake of his solo success, it's been reissued as Keith Urban and The Ranch. I think it was initially Keith Urban in The Ranch. Later on, it became Keith Urban and The Ranch. A really good record, despite all the complications in it being made. And this song has sort of stuck with him for a long time. It's a really up-tempo country rocker that I think he continues to play even today, some 25 years after he recorded it.
My tie so I can breathe. Me, I'm going where the fresh air's blowing. Take a little walk in the country with me. Walk in the country with me. Watch the sun sinking down on the trees. It's gonna do us some good to get down in the woods. Take a little walk. I need some dirt brought onto my feet. Come on, let's point our toes where the red fern grows. Take a little walk in the country with me. Come on now, walk in the country with me. Watch the sun sinking down on the trees. It's gonna do us some good to get down in the woods. Take a little walk in the country with me. Walking in the country.
that was Walk in the Country by Keith Urban and The Ranch, which was specially chosen for us today by our guest, Jeff Apter. And Jeff is the author of a new book, Keith Urban, telling us about Keith's amazing journey from a daydreamer in Brisbane to being a superstar in Nashville and the rest of the world. Jeff, you were just saying about those other influences on Keith Urban, people like AC/DC, Dire Straits, Queen, even Iron Maiden. But he's always been seen as a country artist, even if he expanded the category later on. Is that just something about the tone of his voice, or what actually makes a country singer?
Yeah, it's curious, isn't it? Because what Keith did is, as I say, he recorded this record in America with The Ranch, which was more of a country rock record, which didn't fit with what was being played. And then he really did, I don't want to say modified his style, he acclimatized to what was really breaking through in America at that time. So he made more sort of well-produced, slightly lush country pop records, a bit heavy on the pedal steel, you know, that kind of thing. But when you saw him in concert, he was a rocker. He's always been a rocker. He'll really shred on that guitar and he'll really do it. There's a lot of rock and roll moves. Some of his biggest influences as a performer are people like Freddie Mercury. If he ever lacked inspiration, he'd put on the Queen Live at Wembley DVD and just sit there and soak it in, you know, which was immortalized in the film Bohemian Rhapsody. That kind of stuff really had a big impact on Keith. And cast your mind back to when, of course, he was starting out when he was in his late teens, playing in the pubs and clubs around Queensland. He had to play everything. So he needed to play everything from, as you said, Judas Priest, right through to AC/DC and so on. The series of shows he did in the late 90s and early 2000s, he'd come back to Australia, always came back for a brief period, and quite often he'd do a show at a venue called The Basement, which is more of a jazz venue in Sydney. Small club, you know, he'd sit a couple of hundred people in there at a squeeze. And I saw him play there several times. And on one night, he got Angry Anderson up on stage with him. And they did this roaring version of Bad Boy for Love. It was fantastic, you know, off the cuff. It was totally impromptu. And you could almost see the paint peeling off the walls. They played so loud. And at the end of the song, you know, towards the end of the night, Keith said, like, that's it, the show's over. I mean, I can't top that. That was Angry Anderson. It was just fantastic. While he succeeded in, you know, the country market, he's really much more than that. You know, he's definitely a rocker at heart. He loves John Mellencamp and Springsteen and people like that. But, you know, he has also played with Slim Dusty and Smokey Dawson. So, you know, he's pretty versatile. As for your question, what defines a country act? Well, that's another interesting thing, because Keith doesn't wear the hat.
No.
And if you look at all his contemporaries from that time, you know, people like Alan Jackson and George Strait and Garth Brooks and so on, they all wore the hat. But Keith has pretty good hair. I don't think he needs the hat. So he's sort of a little bit of a square peg. I guess he had the Australian thing going for him, you know, because he was there not so long after that wonderful period of Australiana really succeeded in America through, you know, things like winning the America's Cup and Men at Work, Singing Down Under, and all that kind of, you know, Olivia Newton-John's huge breakthrough. That was a great period in the 80s where Australia, everything Australian was interesting. Paul Hogan and Keith came not too long. It's probably, you know, within 10 years of that. So he still had that going for him as well. So he had a lot of things on his side, but yeah, is he country? He lives in Nashville. That's about the closest I'd say.
Well, his talent, especially on guitar, was obvious right from the start. But he has a lot going for him, as you say. I mean, Dolly Parton has spoken favourably about his appearance, hasn't she?
Yeah. We nicked a quote from Dolly for the cover. It says, every time I make out with my husband, I pretend it's Keith Urban. And I've been joking that I probably should have got a comment from Dolly's husband about that. He probably... I wonder if you say, every time I make out with Dolly, I pretend it's Nicole Kidman.
Yeah, there's certainly a glamour couple. Also, I mean, as well as his qualities of persistence, and I think he's also shown a ruthless ambition to succeed at times, which I guess you have to.
Yeah, that's undeniable. I mean, Keith is the guy you see on shows like The Voice and American Idol. I think is a big chunk of the man, someone that's generous with his time, a fairly compassionate kind of guy, a nice guy, essentially. But when it comes to business, you know, over the course of his career, he's made some tough decisions and been pretty ruthless, you know, cast aside band members. And as a manager, his first big manager was his first real manager, was a Brisbane guy called Greg Shaw, who took Keith to America and From the first time he saw him, in fact, he said, I'm going to make this guy a star. This guy is a star in waiting. Invested a lot of his own money in Keith's career, and just as it started to explode for Keith got rid of him because, you know, which was hard, but the reality is, as so many Australian acts have discovered, you need American management. You need someone who really understands how it works in America, and ideally someone with a lot of clout. And really, very few Australian managers who've gone overseas with their bands have been able to do that, possibly with the exception of Glenn Wheatley and the Little River Band. But even then, I'm sure there's a lot of assistance from people on the ground in America. Keith had to make some tough decisions, and if someone gets in the way of his career, I think he's pretty good at making those tough decisions that can be seen to insiders as a little bit brutal, but the reality is that's how he's kept his career afloat.
And he's also had a lot of lucky breaks. I mean, even going back to that cliche about playing in the Gladesville pub in Sydney and an EMI executive just happened to walk in.
Yeah. And I'd seen him play there. I used to live just around the corner from the Bayview. And, Keith would play there. And I think I said in the book there was more people on stage than in the crowd. But, this guy Brian Harris just happened to be there. And that's the thing about Keith. He really stood out from the pack. He was a good-looking guy. Early on he was sort of a... looked more like Billy Idol than he does today. Mm. But, so he was a very eye-catching kind of character, good-looking guy, moved well, played great, was quite different to a lot of his Australian country peers. And, you know, you could throw people like James Blundell and so on into that mix, who are much more authentically, I guess, Australian, you know, the Kubra wearers with the R.M. William boots and the whole thing. Keith was very, very different and, you know, knew his way around a guitar. Brian Harris spotted him in the pub, signed him to EMI soon after, where he recorded his first record in Australia. So, yeah, there were lucky breaks. Certain networking's a bit overdone, but I think Keith, once he got his feet on the ground in America, really understood the value of surrounding himself with the right people and certainly never missed an opportunity to mix and network with the right people. Keith even turns up, well before he was Keith Urban's solo superstar, turns up in an Alan Jackson video just playing a little cameo. So, you know, a lot of people were helping him get a leg up. And there's a really funny story I relate in the book. Again, it's at that starting point of Keith's career in Nashville, and he's in a parking lot. And by this time, he's played some guitar, which is quite funny. He did guitar overdubs on a Garth Brooks live album, which struck me as really funny, so much for it being live. And so they become kind of... they knew each other, and Garth pulled up next to him in the car park. And Garth's the biggest star in country music in America at the time. And he looked over and he said, "G'day, mate, how's it going?" And Keith was just absolutely blown away. Mm. He called me mate. He actually dashed back to his the people, the Coburns I mentioned previously, and dashed back and ran in and said, "I just saw Garth Brooks, and he called me mate." He knew he was on his way.
Well, another big factor in his life was when he met Nicole Kidman, I think back in 2005, and then eventually got the courage up to ring her up, and she has stood by him. Like he had that breakdown, as you said, in 2006, and she was getting pressure, I suppose, to leave him, but she stuck by him.
Yeah, it's a real love match. And, I mean, again, that was a series of fortunate events. They met at this event called G'day LA. They recognise a few Australians have achieved big things in America. And at that event, it was intended to be, could have been Nicole Kidman, Mel Gibson, and I think it was Delta Goodrum. And people from Keith's camp lobbied to have him on the honorees instead of Delta Goodrum. And he actually got her bumped. Not he got her bumped, but they got her bumped. And which made sense because Keith, by that time, his star had risen really, really high in America. And that's where he met Nicole, you know, and they connected straight away and within months were going out together. But, a series of fortunate events got them together. And then what they did, once they became a couple and got through that trauma of Keith having what I understand to be just one big night out, which led to him going back into rehab and really getting himself together. He spent, I think, 90 days in there during that stint. Mm-hmm. Is that they make time for each other's careers. There's lots of stories of Keith being on the road and having a two-day break and Nicole being on a set somewhere. And he's going, "Great, I can go and spend a couple of days with you," and vice versa. And in fact, you know, their first child was conceived on the set of the film Australia, which I thought was really funny. It was filmed, I think, in the Kimberley somewhere. And Keith went over, he had a few-day break, he caught up with Nicole. She ended up becoming pregnant, as did six other women in the cast and crew on the set of that film. I'm not saying Keith was involved with it, by the way. Don't get me wrong. So there was something about that. And You know, it's very rare you don't see them together. So I think they really make an effort to be available for each other and also be engaged with each other's career. During lockdown, Keith did a lot of social media stuff, almost karaoke-style stuff from the warehouse where he stores his gear, and he did a carpool karaoke-type thing, and he also did a drive-in concert, literally at a drive-in theatre just outside of Nashville for frontline workers. And at all those events, you know, Nicole's involved with him, and sometimes even singing with him. So obviously, you know, it's a real love match, but at the same time, they also make time for each other's careers and lives and sort of find a way to fit in.
Well, in July 2021, it had to be a highlight for Keith when he was invited to sing Imagine at the opening of the Tokyo Olympics. At the age of 55, where to from here, do you think?
It's really interesting. Well, like I said earlier, his last couple of records have been really quite experimental, and I reckon he's going to keep pursuing that path, collaborating with a lot of unlikely people. Like I said before, he's worked with Taylor Swift, Pink, even Nile Rodgers, the legendary guitarist from Chic, and you know, played on David Bowie's Let's Dance. He's worked with Ed Sheeran. So I think he's going to continue on that path as long as he possibly can. When I started writing that piece, you know, probably almost 25 years ago now, there was a lot of thought among his peers that he might go and do a really, really rootsy, traditional country record, perhaps even like bluegrass or an instrumental record or something like that. Maybe he's still got that in the toolkit, but it's interesting that he's gone in a completely different direction with a lot of his recent recordings, which have gone into, you know, almost dance music, you know, what they call EDM, you know, electronic dance music, and really contemporary sounding records. So I don't know. I think he'll continue with that. He'll continue with TV. And the only frontier he hasn't really had a foothold in is Hollywood. I think he'd be a pretty good character actor, actually. So maybe he should have a word with Nicole. She could set him up with a few roles.
You've got some good influence there, yes. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. It is always such a great pleasure getting to speak with Jeff Apter. And Jeff has his new book out now called Keith Urban, which I can thoroughly recommend, about our own Aussie superstar. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners, and you can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email. We'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to your favourite podcast or our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. So it just remains for me now to give a special thank you, Jeff Apter. Jeff, thank you very much for once again coming on Dads on the Air.
No, Bill, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for your time. That was great.
We'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.